Curtis LeMay, the firebombing of Tokyo, and the road to the atomic bomb. James Scott, the historian, is the author, and he's here to help us understand Curtis LeMay's success. We begin, however, with Curtis LeMay's biography. James, you have introduced me to the possibility that LeMay is extremely admirable. He's by his bootstraps. He's a poor kid who's given a bad break in life, and he doesn't let him push him down. Where does he come from? What do we make of his, what you'd have to say is self-invention?
Exactly. I mean, he comes from this hardscrabble childhood. I mean, his father was kind of a drifty ne'er-do-well who uproots the family repeatedly as he sort of goes from one, you know, manual labor job to the next. They move from Ohio to Montana to California. You know, his mother cleans houses to help make ends meet. LeMay and his siblings are just kind of left to fend for themselves. So he learns from a very young age that he can really only depend on himself in life. I mean, none of his teachers, his parents, nobody really shows much of an interest in him. And so he very quickly becomes self-reliable, so much so that he literally puts himself through college at Ohio State by working all night in a steel mill. And so he's literally up all night working in a steel mill and then going to class during the day. I mean, he's just a tireless, dogged worker. He studies engineering at Ohio State, and he has a problem solving mindset. I mean, he really sets out to tackle things like equations. And so he brings that early on to the war in Europe, where he goes over and he really helps design better bomber formations to help improve the defenses of the B-17s. He also tackles the problem of German anti-aircraft fire. And he realizes that, you know, it takes the Germans a lot longer to figure out where in the skies bombers are and in order to be able to sight them, and that they can fly longer, straighter bombing runs and get more bombs on target. As an individual, you know, his sort of hardscrabble childhood really shapes his personality in a lot of ways, because, you know, he spent his whole time looking out for himself and sort of hustling to, you know, part-time jobs and as a high schooler and in the steel mill, that he loses that sort of time in life to sort of develop the social polish and grace that Haywood Hansel had, who'd grown up sort of the son of an aristocratic army family, you know? And so LeMay's quiet and reserved. He's uncomfortable in big situations. He prefers people who do things. Early in the war, develops Bell's palsy, which is a form of facial paralysis. And there's really nothing you can do for it to sort of ride it out. But that's when he decides he's going to start chewing on a cigar in order to mask the fact that his right side of his cheek sort of droops. And so he's a really fascinating character, I think, in this
world. I agree with you, James. Of all the scenes, you give us wonderful scenes just in passing, because this is a war story. But before the war, he never had time for dating or going to dances. And I believe he was at Ohio State at this point in a fraternity, and there's a dance, and he's told that he's got to go to dancing lessons because he doesn't know how to dance. And then is this the night where he's approaching, and from the point of view of the woman who will become his wife, she looks out and she sees these two fellows walking. I hope I have this right, James.
You do,
And she says, "I'll take the fat one." I love him for this. Because he's pudgy, and he's like a bulldog,
exactly.
Like a bulldog.
Exactly, he looks like a bulldog, and he and a buddy have been set up on these blind dates, and the two girls are looking out of the home they live in, and she says, "I'll take the fat one," and that ends up becoming his wife, and she provided later in life. That sort of, she was the social diplomat and the graceful one, whereas, you know, he was the commander, the quiet, reserved, and so they made a really great pairing. But you're absolutely right. He lacked all that, and there were times, and this is he writes at one point, there were times in high school when, because he didn't participate in sports, he didn't date. He was working all the time. I mean, he was delivering telegrams, he was delivering newspapers, he was constantly hustling to make money and to be able to put himself through school and whatnot. And he says, you know, there were times in high school when I lay down at night and thought about all the things I was missing out on that all my peers were doing. But most nights I was just too tired.
Yes. And Helen is educated. So she gives him Helen LeMay, who becomes his wife and the mother of his daughter. She gives him the momentum to go back and get his degree, because one of the things he did at the steel mill was lack sleep. So he calculated that if I sleep through my first class, I'll get through the rest of the day. Well, that first class left him short of the degree. And so Helen encouraged him to go back. He falls in love with flying. Need to get to him on in the Marianas. He arrives in Guam because he's not been successful with the B-29 out of China. Again, the weather's a problem, but also the range doesn't allow them to strike into the main islands in Japan. And so there's a change in the air. Hap Arnold loses patience with Hansel's Take Me 6 Weeks. And abruptly, Hansel is replaced by Curtis LeMay. Curtis LeMay arrives, and he, at first, is flabbergasted at low morale and bad organization. How so, James?
Exactly. And it's important to remember, so Hansel is fired after literally about 44 days of operations. That's it. And that shows you how little patience Arnold had. In fact, one of Arnold's aides once said that, and this is a great quote, he said, Arnold would have fired his mother if she didn't produce results. I mean, he was a results-oriented commander. So he fires Hansel, he brings LeMay in. And LeMay and Hansel actually have known each other. They're friendly. They'd actually worked together in Europe. In fact, going through LeMay's personal papers, I found a commendation letter that Hansel, who'd been LeMay's boss, wrote congratulating him on his great success in Europe. Hansel had actually advocated that LeMay be promoted to the rank of brigadier general. And so when LeMay arrives on Guam in January of 1945, he's there to replace his former boss. And Hansel gives him some advice. And he says, look, I've been adhering to high altitude daylight precision bombing. This is the tactics. This is, you know, what we need to do. Remember, LeMay, that in the end, we're going to be judged not by whether we win the war, but by how we win the war. And LeMay says to Hansel, look, I'm going to continue doing high altitude daylight precision bombing until it either works or doesn't work. And so when LeMay begins operations, that's what he does. He takes what Hansel's been doing, but he's a problem solver. And he starts tinkering with the equation. He brings the bombers down 5,000 feet, hoping to get them underneath those jet streams and the cloud cover. You know, he sets out to revamp the maintenance program because he always says, look, you can't bomb a target from a grounded plane. So you got to get more planes in the air. So you got to improve maintenance. Hansel was not a huge fan of radar because it had the ability. It was not a refined weapon. So, you know, you were going to have misses and things like that and create civilian casualties. LeMay embraces it, starts training his crews in that. So he's tinkering. He's trying to figure out how to solve the problem of bombing Japan. And he ultimately comes to realize it's an unsolvable equation if you use the same variables that Hansel had been doing. And that's the decision. It takes him about 6 weeks to come to that realization. But that becomes sort of the defining fulcrum for LeMay and how he's going to shift tactics in order to fight the war against Japan.
And the frustration includes the morale on the Marianas, on Guam. Another detail I liked, I don't remember who was complaining to him, but they have to deal with the native tribes. And they want to be paid in opium. His subordinate comes to LeMay and said, what'll I do? You can tell the story, James.
Yeah, so that's actually when LeMay, but right before he gets to the Marianas, he spends a little bit of time in India and China, flying, commanding B-29s that are going against targets in southern Japan. And so LeMay at that point is, he's such a pragmatist. So he's trying to get for crews that go down in the jungles. He needs to be able to rescue them. And so he goes, the natives, he reaches out to some of these native tribes and they say, well, you know, we need your help. And they don't want money. They want opium. And so LeMay's exasperated subordinate comes in and he says, you know, we can't pay them in opium. You know, what are we going to do here? And LeMay said, if they want opium, you're going to pay them in opium. And he goes, well, how are we going to log that for accounting purposes? And so they come up with the idea that they'll just put fertilizer. But for LeMay, again, it was, I'm not going to let bureaucracy get in the way of the results I need. And the results I need here are I need indigenous help to get my air crews back. And if they want opium, we will give them opium, you know, because we've got these trained pilots and airmen. We need them. And again, problem solver.
The strategic bombing is no more successful for LeMay than it had been for Hansel. In fact, the weather's getting worse because we're moving from winter towards springtime. A slight detour here about the development of a weapon that will also be necessary. I did not know until James reminds us all with his very careful research that the U.S. Army Air Force and the combined chiefs had prepared what we call napalm today. They invented it at this period of time. And there were two bombs, the M-47 and the M-69. But they built a village. Where was it? In Utah, James? Is that where they
built it? Utah, the deserts of Utah. So exactly. So when the war breaks out, you know, America realizes that we don't have a very good, reliable flame weapon. And so we set out to develop one. And actually, in that process, you see the rise of napalm. And it's actually first tested on the soccer field at Harvard on Independence Day, 1942, is where the first ever use of napalm takes place. And so once they develop the weapon, they realize, all right, we need to test it on a Japanese city to see if it works. And so they actually hire a protege of Frank Lloyd Wright. Of course, Frank Lloyd Wright had spent a lot of time working in Japan, designing buildings, whatnot. So they hire one of his proteges who helps them design a mock Japanese village in the deserts of Utah. And they really are after total authenticity here because they want to be able to test how well they'll burn. So they actually build a tatami mat factory in Utah. And of course, tatami mats are that iconic woven floor covering that you find in Japanese houses. They used sliding screen doors, seating pillows, everything. And over the summer of 1943, we burned that village down over and over and over again as we tested these incendiaries to figure out which one would be the best weapon to take against Japanese cities. At the same time, war planners, of course, had really began analyzing Japanese cities and looking, and they realized in the wake of the 1923 earthquake, which produced a subsequent fire that burned much of Tokyo and Yokohama, the Japanese cities had an Achilles heel. And that Achilles heel was that they were dense, they were largely made out of wood, they lacked parks, open spaces, and fire breaks. And that if you could start a fire in a Japanese city, you could burn it down. And so these analysts start looking at how, like, what are the densest parts of Japanese cities? And they create literally profiles of every major city broken down by incendiary zones. Like an incendiary zone one would be an area highly susceptible to fire. And so when LeMay is beginning his bombing out there, people in Washington, they built him the perfect weapon in the form of a new incendiary bomb. He's got a perfect new bomber in the B-29. And he's also got incredible target data on all of Japan's major cities broken down on what parts are most flammable.
Curtis LeMay is a practical thinker. And when we come back, Curtis LeMay has a plan, his plan. The book is Black Snow, Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo, and The Road to the Atomic Bomb. James Scott is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.